Okay, so Adam, let's discuss David Sinclair's new paper on aging. We'll do Amazon prescription pass. We'll do this new Nature paper on the decline in disruptive science. And then we'll do this story about non-diabetics taking metformin in San Francisco. So do you want to start with the Sinclair paper?
Yeah, this is super interesting. It's been making the rounds in the aging community, and it's there's a bit of a juicy controversy going on there. I'll explain the paper first. So this is a new paper from the David Sinclair lab testing or claiming to test the information theory of aging. Now, this is one of the most interesting theories in the aging field. And it basically says that our bodies get old. The reason why we get old is this loss of epigenetic information with age. And what that means is the way our cells operate is the cells know how to function because the cell reads the genetic information in our genome, and then it and that helps cells function. But with age, cells lose the ability to read the genetic material because of this loss of epigenetic information, which causes cells to lose identity. David Sinclair explains it as a CD with scratches that accumulate with age that prevent prevent reading of the information on the CD.
Wait, Adam, so what I never understood about this information theory of aging is I thought this was pretty like well known. I thought this was common consensus. So I don't really understand what the difference is between what Sinclair says and what
exactly
we've already known for decades.
So that's what people say, is like this has been in like the hallmarks of aging since like forever. Loss of epigenetic information has been like a hallmark of aging. It's not the single driver of aging, but it's like one of, but the theory, I mean, it's a bit different in mechanism, but it's also different in the fact that this is kind of the upstream ultimate cause of aging, and then everything else is kind of downstream from loss of epigenetic information. That's the idea. The way they tested it in this paper is that they induced DNA breaks in, so they brought a few mice and they gave them certain chemicals that induced breaks in their DNA. But mm-hmm. then your cells kind of naturally repair those breaks, right? But when you repair those breaks, it doesn't go back to exactly the way it was. It's kind of like cutting a wire and then welding it back together. There's a bit of a change there, right? And and so they did that. The cells aged, but then what they did is they did another intervention that they call reprogramming, epigenetic reprogramming, where they removed these kind of chemical alterations of DNA that happen with repair, and then that kind of reduced the age of the organism of the mice. It's a beautiful paper. I loved it because it's really well written. It's a really elegant theory. But like it created a bit of a stir in the scientific community because loads of other aging labs have came out to question this paper, and they even kind of insinuate that there's a bit of I wouldn't say fraud, but it's kind of hype that is unwarranted.
So if I'm understanding correctly, they take some DNA in mice, they cause some breaks in it, then they fix those breaks, and then that tells us something about his information theory of aging. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, basically how it goes is they induce the breaks, the organism fixes the breaks, but the organism still ages rapidly even after fixing the breaks. Because what changed here is the epigenome. So the breaks are still intact. The DNA is intact, but it's more like the epigenetic signature has changed. Then what they do is they basically inject the mice with these modified viruses carrying certain genes that reverses these epigenetic changes. And this leads to gain of function, and it leads to kind of reducing the age-related changes that have happened, and this kind of the age-related changes in muscle and kidneys and in the eyesight of the mice. So it actually does do something, which is quite interesting.
Fine. So they cause some breaks, they let the organism fix it itself. Then once the organism has fixed it itself, that has in some ways aged a little bit, and then they inject it with something that then reverses this whole process, and then that kind of gives some proof or some evidence for his information theory of aging. Is that
correct? I mean, that's the conclusion they make. They say that we were able to accelerate aging and then reverse aging at will. And that's where it gets a bit into the hype territory, because what people say is that breaking DNA itself, regardless of loss of epigenetic information, causes aging anyway. There's also an issue of the measurement of aging. So the measurement of aging in mice has been reversed in some way, but not in every single way. There's also a question of, so this was a tweet by Matt Caberlane, who is kind of a bit of a rival of David Sinclair. He works at a different lab. I think they worked together in the past or something. But he's done this before, where they produced kind of research that contradicts the findings of the Sinclair lab. So he said something like, actually, I'll read his tweet. He said, rocket ship emojis and press releases aside, right? This is like kind of a dig at Sinclair and press, like focusing on press releases and tweets rather than the science. We are 7 years on from the first in vivo report. In vivo means in animals, of anti-aging from epigenetic reprogramming. Epigenetic reprogramming is the name of this therapy, in a mouse. And so far, nobody has done better than rapamycin or anywhere close to calorie restriction. So rapamycin and calorie restriction are kind of the interventions with the highest level of evidence of reversing or slowing the age-related decline in mice. So he's basically saying we're 7 years on doing epigenetic reprogramming, and we haven't even produced results that are near what we already do with rapamycin or calorie restriction. So he's kind of saying, like, why are we focusing on this when we have better stuff that has higher potential?
So David Sinclair is obviously a professor at Harvard Medical School, although I don't think he's a physician by training. I really enjoyed his book Lifespan, but when I'm reading it, I do get like a 10% of me, my kind of like snake oil radar kind of gets tipped off a little bit with some of the stuff he does. Is he in this space of longevity researchers and such? Is he legit, basically? What's his deal?
Like, he's legit, but he's so good at marketing. Like, I'm actually quite impressed by him. He's a really good marketer, don't you think? He's really good at navigating that kind of world of being legit, but also being interviewed on Time Magazine and having bestseller books and doing, you know, Joe Rogan. So what he does is he converts like the scientific findings to something that is like way, he kind of extrapolates, maybe a bit too much, but he makes it compelling. And what I think scientists don't like is that he does that for things that are, for example, there's a one of his controversies is his issue with resveratrol and sirtuins. So he leaded some research that led to the development of a compound called or testing of a compound called resveratrol and other compounds that are similar to it. He actually co-founded a company that was studying the effect of resveratrol and similar compounds on age-related diseases. He made like millions of this company. He sold it to GSK, and it flopped. Basically, it turned out it was it didn't work. Like, they spent billions developing these drugs after they bought the company, and it didn't work. So some people kind of accuse him of hyping up that, because he's done this in the past. He's been hyping up, like, he used to hype up resveratrol and his previous research. Now he's doing this with information theory of aging. He connects both of them in one single theory, but some people are kind of accusing him of hyping up his research to create demand for his companies.
I saw this really interesting framework on a blog post ages ago, but it was about scientists and how they can basically be interesting or become good marketers. And it basically said that, like, science as a whole, I mean, it can be interesting, but a lot of it's pretty dry, it's pretty specific. But they said to unlock this kind of virality and popularity, you have to fuse your science with self-help advice. And I think in all the big kind of popular scientists right now, so we think of like Andrew Huberman, Maybe Peter Attia to a degree, definitely Matthew Walker, the sleep guy, and definitely David Sinclair. There's always a degree of like self-help and a bit of extrapolation and a bit of like, here's a mouse study, and if you take the same chemicals as this mouse, you're going to live to 150. So I think that's a really interesting framework where you just, you marry your science or whatever with self-help advice. And I mean, I lap it up. I love it.
Yeah, it's kind of like evidence-based self-improvement. But the thing is, like, so many people get away with like talking absolute shit, right? In the self-help world, and no one bats an eyelid. But when a scientist tries to do it in an evidence-based way, he gets attacked or she gets attacked. I think we kind of over-focus on scientists and people who are legit when they try and navigate that world a bit too much. Because like people are out there promoting like all kinds of bullshit. At least these people are trying to make it evidence-based and like keep it a bit grounded in science. And I think there is a bit of, I would say, like kind of jealousy towards the people like David Sinclair from other scientists who, because like, think of it this way, the kind of science world, you're working on something that is like super interesting to you, but no one else cares. Like you're the person who is like boring everyone out when you're talking about like these molecular biomedical experiments that you're carrying out. When someone asks you what do you do, when you start explaining, they're like, oh, you know, this is like the most boring thing ever. So for those who have the ability to translate the boring stuff to more interesting stuff, they become like rock stars of the science community. And I think people like scientists don't like that. They start attacking these people for the hype they generate. But I think a lot of it is pure jealousy.
So last week I was at this YouTube health event in London where, yeah, Vishal Virani is a doctor. He's launched or he's heading up UK's version of YouTube Health. And there are a few big medical YouTubers on stage. And I asked the question, which is basically, if you want to give legit health advice or like legit self-improvement health advice, it's basically pretty simple, right? It's like eat well, sleep, exercise, be around people. Like it's not rocket science, and all of this actually exists, and national bodies have loads of guidelines. Like all the stuff that's legit, basically everyone already knows about, and where doctors are already advising it, right? But I think there's another framework or another pressure that these health influencers feel, where to be interesting, you have to give something contrarian, you have to say something interesting. I don't think it's possible to really reach virality, become really big, just saying the evidence-backed stuff. I think there has to be a degree of speculation. You have to think of, you know, talking about random research chemicals or random mice studies. Like, you have to have something there. So I have a lot of sympathy for them, basically. I think it's a very difficult job.
It is, yeah. It's super difficult to, yeah, make it interesting. But it's also, maybe it's just like a bad business to be in.
Although I'm guessing Sinclair is probably a deca, if not 100 centi millionaire.
He's doing well. Yeah,
and
but that's the thing. Like because he's really good at hype. if he was like super grounded and didn't engage in hype at all, he wouldn't be as successful as he is. But the thing is, sometimes it's not a bad thing because he's probably generated a lot of interest in the field. He's probably brought in a lot of funding. So back in the day of early days of longevity, Aubrey de Grey was the hype man, right? Aubrey de Grey, if you haven't heard of him, he was the first person to give he gave a TED talk back in the day about radical life extension. He founded the SENS Foundation, S-E-N-S. But anyway, he was the original David Sinclair. He was like a big hype longevity person. And he probably like single-handedly kickstarted a huge industry and a lot of funding into this space. A lot of what he said wasn't evidence-based, but it was kind of like optimistic, like a very optimistic way of interpreting science. And I think there's always going to be the pessimists who put the optimists down, and they're right. Like pessimists are always right, but the optimists are the ones who kind of drive things forward.
If you're David Sinclair and you had his clout and his name brand recognition in the space,
I would retire.
But how are you making? You just want to do a cash grab. You just want to make a ton of money. What would you do? Would you do like a supplement? Would you do a business?
Well, that's what he did. He literally what he did.
He's done that.
He created a company, basically that was looking into a resveratrol supplement, and he's on. I think he's on. He's part of companies doing NMN, which is another supplement that doesn't work.
is that the money? And because I can imagine if you're like a rich tech person in the US and you're set on living for ages, I'm guessing he's top of your kind of list of people to call up. Is there much money in kind of personalized coaching? I'm guessing
I don't think someone like David Sinclair would be a good coach. Like these people, most of these scientists who are popping in this space, all their experience is dealing with mice. So unless you're a mouse, I won't call up David Sinclair. That's where like PTRT is quite interesting, because he is an actual physician who deals with patients. That's where what I do, basically. I translate all the stuff that comes from basic research and clinical research into like actionable advice with patients. It's a totally different world, because you need to be grounded, like, or you're going to like harm the patient.
Awesome. Anything else to say on that? Shall we move on to the Amazon story?
Yeah, we can move on. What's the Amazon story?
So Amazon just recently launched RX Pass, or Prescription Pass, I think it's meant to be said. So this is basically Bezos has just entered the group chat in terms of pharmaceuticals. So essentially, it's a service where Amazon Prime users can pay $5 a month and they can get all of their regular prescriptions under that price, basically. So it's just a total of $5 every month. And they've got like 80 medications, like generics. They've got stuff like Losartan, which is for blood pressure, sertraline, antidepressant.
Wait, so you don't have to pay for sertraline or whatever?
No. I think as long as you've got the prescription, you just kind of, you get it through your Amazon Prime, basically. And it's a flat fee. So you could be on 20 meds and it's still $5 a month.
Wow.
You can even get finasteride, which is the big hair loss drug, which is normally $260 a month retail. So you're getting that all
the time. I don't think so.
Is it not? That's what Amazon say it is.
Yeah, that's probably like, this is what a lot of these companies do, like Mark Cuban's
cost plus drugs.
So what they do is basically they find like one medication that, finasteride is an off-patent drug.
Yeah.
But if you buy a generic, it's super cheap. But if you wanted to buy, I think it's Propecia,
yeah.
Yeah, is the main one. Yeah, that might be still expensive, but no one buys that anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
But they won't advertise that on the website. But that's what Mark Cuban does. They reduce one drug, like insulin or something that's really popular, and that generates the headlines. And then they sell all the other drugs at basically the same price as any other pharmacy. But they use one drug as kind of free advertisement.
Wait, so yeah. So the background of Mark Cuban's thing is that he's a billionaire. He's on Shark Tank. He owns the Dallas Mavericks, which is a basketball team. And essentially, he's a guy who has fuck you money. And he's decided the state of the US pharmaceutical industry is a joke in terms of how much patients and insurers are being charged or charging for drugs. So he has this formula where he has this website called costplusdrugs.com. You pay for the cost of the drug, 15% markup. There's a small pharmacy fee and then delivery, and that's it. So the headline one on that, so this is interesting because you're basically a cancer doctor. So imatinib, which is quite an expensive cancer drug, I think the 1 month supply for the brand version of that is $2,500, and on Cost Plus Drugs you can get it for $14 a month. So it's like a huge reduction, right? So are you not impressed by that?
So no, because that's the story, right? But there's a million other pharmacies who do that. Like, this is not a new thing.
Yeah.
They all use like most even Cost Plus Drugs, by the way. They used TruPill, which is basically a kind of API pharmacy where anyone, so I can literally build this in a week, just sign an agreement with TruPill, pay yourself a markup and do it that way. So they actually are on top of TruPill. If you go to TruPill, you can find Cost Plus Drugs on their website and like 10 other online pharmacies. So they're not doing anything innovative. It's literally just a front for an existing pharmacy who do it.
So Amazon's Prescription Pass and Mark Cuban's Cost Plus Drugs is basically, it's just like, again, good hype around
the Cost Plus Drugs, absolutely. I saw something from Martin Shkreli on this, you know, pharma bro. He was the guy who was in the news because he jacked up some medication, like an HIV medication, and he went to prison for fraud or whatever. But he's a guy who was an insider in the like pharma space, and he had some interesting insights on this. The Amazon one is interesting because I think they're fine losing money on this because they're bringing you into Amazon Prime, and that's the whole point. You come into Amazon Prime, they're going to be losing money on the pharmacy side, but they're getting the money back from all the commerce they get when locking you into Amazon.
Yeah, so I mean, okay, yeah. So I agree with you. I don't think it's particularly innovative. And the other competitors are also like, I think the US has Kroger's and Walgreens, and they have similar things they call prescription savings clubs, which is essentially you pay, and some of these you pay like $36 a year, and you get like all of your kind of off-brand drugs under that, in terms of what the ones they offer, which is actually for a lot of chronic conditions. So they're pretty good. So this stuff already exists. Like the Amazon price would in total be, Prime is about $140 a year. And then this thing on top of that would be $60. So you'd be paying $200 a year. So I agree. I don't think it's a particularly like a paradigm shifting development, but it's cool to see Amazon enter the business anyway. They had their acquisition of, I think it was PillPack in 2018. That was like $1 billion acquisition. They've done some more in this space as well. So I think, yeah, it's not particularly innovative, but it is Amazon, the behemoth, entering the situation is, I think,
yeah, exciting. Yeah, I mean, I think it's great for the consumer, for patients eventually. Like, those are the people who get the savings.
Yeah, I think this is a good example of where capitalism actually benefits people. It gets a pretty bad rep, especially in the UK and health, but I think it's a good thing here.
Yeah, it eventually... Yeah, eventually works.
The kind of cynical take on this is that Amazon are going to do what they've probably done in retail, and there's a ton of like antitrust suits after them from like the European Commission and some other countries as well, where they'll come in, they'll, as you said, this will be a kind of loss leader, they'll bleed the market dry, and then as soon as everyone else is dead, they'll raise prices. Which
But what they will do is probably, so right now they probably don't make the drugs, but they might go into that business and start making, like if they know they can sell this amount of money on like finasteride, for example, they can start making it themselves and get and kind of integrate horizontally that way or vertically,
which sounds like a good thing, to be honest. I guess the bad part of it would be them just
the makers of finasteride. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sucks to be them, but overall. But also, the other interesting bit of context is that if you compare it to the situation we have in the UK with the NHS, your subscription is £10.80 a month and you can have unlimited prescriptions. So it's just interesting to compare. I know it's a very different system, but it's just interesting to think like we have a pretty sweet deal over here in socialized systems as well. So I think that's like interesting bit of context.
Yeah.
And like the last point I just wanted to make on this was that it's interesting to see big companies like Apple, Amazon, Google enter health. And I guess the take on this is that they've probably expanded as much as they can, or there's a limited amount of space left in like consumer electronics or retail or books, etc. Like fundamentally, there's a limited number of things people want to consume. But health is kind of the big new untapped market. So it's interesting, you know, Apple hit $3 trillion in market cap recently. I don't know how much more room there is, you know, selling iPhones and iPads or whatever. Maybe they're moving into AR and VR. But health is like the new hot thing that all these big players are moving into.
Yeah, I think there's so much inefficiency, especially in the American system. But in general, like there's a lot of inefficiency that can be exploited by these companies.
Definitely. Do you want to talk about this non-diabetics taking metformin story?
Yeah, metformin is one of the earliest drugs that has been touted as a longevity drug. It's been in the news a few times, but apparently it's becoming a thing, especially in San Francisco, where people are taking metformin like it's the new birth control pill. No one talks about it, but everyone is on it. There was a tweet about it that went viral. And I wanted to talk about that a bit because where does the evidence come from? It comes from this big observational study. It was done in the UK where they looked at a huge data set of people on metformin who, it's a diabetes drug, by the way. Metformin is given, is the first line of a prescription for anyone with diabetes. So large numbers of people on metformin who are diabetic, compared them to people who are healthy or not diabetic who are not taking metformin. And people who are on metformin had a lower rate of cancer. They had the lower rate of, I think they had a lower rate of all-cause mortality. So there was a signal there that maybe metformin, like even though they were diabetic, right, which is already a risk factor for all of these issues. So maybe metformin is protective. So that's why there's a study being, well, it's on halt right now, but because they're waiting for funding. But it was designed by Nir Berzelay, who you've, I think, talked to in the past. But he designed the TAME study, which is basically looking at metformin as a longevity drug as a in a prospective study. But there's the problem here is what? The problem here is that there's a few other studies that came out since that observational study that kind of gives a bit a different story. A lot of hype has been generated around metformin because it's like a cheap drug. It's a relatively safe drug. Most people won't have any side effects taking it, so people feel confident taking it. But is it actually doing anything? There was an interesting video recently by a guy called Brad. What's his name?
Dr. Brad. I'm not sure.
Dr. Brad, something. Yeah. Anyway. Where he does a good job of like going through the evidence. Well, basically, the one main study that contradicts the first study is this prospective study.
I think originally, like the big observational study that you described, the UK one, that's observational. So the key point being that it's not very good evidence. It's kind of like all the studies we see on nutrition that recommend drinking red wine or not eating red meat or whatever. There's that it's a pretty weak evidence. But then this new study, which tested, was prospective. So they took, I think, a group of people who were on the verge of developing diabetes, and they randomized them. So they gave one group metformin, and they gave one group a placebo, so basically a sugar pill, or actually just a pill, no sugar in it. And they found basically that when they randomized it, and I think they followed them for like 2 decades, there was no difference in mortality. So in like the higher quality evidence that's come out recently, it really doesn't show that there's any longevity benefit for non-diabetics to take metformin, essentially, which is what everyone, kind of all the tech bros, all the tech girls, all the San Francisco crowd who have been taking kind of metformin secretly have been hoping for. So I guess we're at a stage now, like, you know a lot more about this than me, but we're at a stage where the evidence for metformin as a life extension drug is pretty weak, and there's actually some pretty good evidence that there's some side effects as well, right?
Yeah, so I would say on average, it's probably not effective for longevity purposes based on the study. But there is some evidence that it does benefit like certain types of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the kind of compromise here is it's a relatively safe drug. It might benefit some people. We don't know who it benefits. So there's no harm in trying it if you fit a certain criteria. And then measuring its effect on your health.
So under medical supervision.
Under medical supervision, obviously. Yeah. It's a prescription medication.
Yeah.
So that's where I would... So this is what I would say to a patient who is asking for metformin, for example. If you're kind of over 40, if you have some kind of high risk for diabetes, or have pre-diabetes or insulin resistance, I wouldn't mind prescribing metformin, but I would want to see an improvement in those markers over like 6 months, for example.
Another point I want to pick up on from Nir Berzelay is this really interesting concept of antagonistic pleiotropy and relating to aging. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah. So basically what it explains is that one single gene in the body, in your cell, can control more than one trait, right? So it could promote growth, but it also can promote something else. And when the gene is beneficial in your younger age, but then is detrimental or like harmful in older age, that's what antagonistic pleiotropy is. And it basically comes from the fact that evolution selects for fitness early on in life and doesn't care about what happens after say 30 or 40 years of age. What comes of this is that some interventions can be beneficial in your older age because, for example, metformin is the one that Nir Berzelay talks about in this context. He says that if you're over 40, it may have beneficial effects, but younger than 40, like, well, why would you be taking it? And that actually is interesting, because I get people reaching out to me on Twitter who are like 24 and they're like, I want to start rapamycin. It's like, you're 24. Like, you know, just, yeah, don't worry about it. Like, don't worry about rapamycin until you're in your like 50s or 40s at least.
Do you get those DMs where people send you like blood test results from like done in Spain or something, and they like want you to interpret them? Do you get
that? Yeah. I get all of that. No, it's like, because these people are like 24 years old. They read this stuff online and they want to start this stuff now. They think if they start earlier, like the earlier you start, the better. And there is some evidence to show that in like flies or whatever, but in humans, it's way more complex than flies and worms and even mice. We have no idea what the effects of these drugs would be on starting young. We might stunt the growth of this person. We might even cause like early diseases that we wouldn't expect. So it's quite risky to start these interventions early on. So I would say, yeah, I would agree with Nirbir's lie on that. Like, what we do after 40 as a kind of a rough mark is way different than what we do when you're younger.
Fine. So last thing I wanted to talk about was this headline Nature paper that I think was published on the 4th of January 23. So this was on the front paper of like the godfather of science journals, Nature. And essentially their finding was that despite the fact that we're publishing more science than ever, we're becoming less disruptive. They did this really cool thing. So they look at 45 million papers and 4 million patents, and they make this thing called the CD index. So the CD index basically says that there's two things we can do when we're doing science, right? The C means consolidation. So we're taking like stuff we already know and just writing papers and making studies that are kind of confirming it, right? So that's kind of like incremental progress. It's like the small steps. Then there's like disruptive science. So that's what the D stands for. So CD index. Disruption is when you get the paradigm shifting stuff, the new stuff that really changes the direction and makes us question everything we believed. And they made this index and they applied it to all this research over the past, I think, 6 decades. And essentially they found that, yeah, we're publishing way more science and it's way less disruptive than before. So I think what the interesting bit maybe is their analysis of why this is happening. And I'd be curious about your thoughts here, but they essentially, the three reasons they say that this is happening is first that there's...
Before we go into that, because I didn't actually read like the paper in detail, but the thing that stood out to me was I just looked at the reduction in quality of disruptive research over time, and it started to go down rapidly after the 50s, which is coincidentally when peer review started to become a thing. I think there might be a correlation there. There's a really good article about how peer review has basically ruined science. Like, it's a good idea in theory, but in practice, it just doesn't work and it leads to less disruptive science being done.
I think that's fair. So you think the peer review process, by the fact that you have to get a number of your fellow peers in the field to kind of vet what you say and approve it, that kind of reduces the variability and like these brainshot or loonshot ideas?
Yeah, because basically what you get is, in like practicality, what happens is you either get your friends, people you know, to peer review. If you're like a well-established researcher, people will know you. They'll kind of do it for you, and then you do it for them. There's a tit for tat component. And then there's also the kind of older generation, the old guard, aren't as receptive to new ideas as the younger generation. So there's a bit of that. They would be kind of less receptive to disruptive research. And then there's a nice article about this, but basically it says that all of the issues that peer review tries to solve are actually not solved. One of them is, for example, publishing bad science. What happens in reality is you go to one journal, they don't publish it because it doesn't go through their peer review. You just go to another one. Eventually you'll find someone who'll publish it, and it's still published. So it doesn't actually prevent bad science, but it just has these like third order effects that lead to less disruptive science being made.
And I guess the big scandal that links to this was the Alzheimer's amyloid plaque hypothesis. And from my kind of understanding, it was basically that we've for decades not really had a lot of progress in Alzheimer's prevention or treatment. And it seemed like the fundamental building blocks of what we believed causes Alzheimer's, which seemed to be this kind of amyloid plaque theory and buildup of plaque. Like, those original studies had been, the data had been fabricated. So we'd basically been going down the wrong track for so long, and that might have contributed to why we've not made as much progress as we'd like to.
Yeah, which is what peer review was supposed to prevent.
But
it doesn't. And it never does. That's the thing. Like, there's so many examples of this.
Yeah. The explanations they gave, they didn't give peer review as an example, I don't think, from my look over. They said there's a reduction...
Well, this is more of a bro science Twitter kind of theory.
So they said... oh, no, I prefer those ones. So they said there's a reduction in the diversity of work being cited. So there's kind of like this Pareto distribution where the top 1% of papers are being cited, you know, 99% of the time. They said there's more self-citation, which the cynical take on it is just people kind of trying to up their own citations. Other take could be that people are just more, they're just staying to what they know. And then the last point I thought was interesting is this links to another kind of tech bro concept, but it was that we're increasingly citing older work in our science. And this, I think, is a really interesting point because there's a lot of narrative on, have you heard of this thing like the Lindy effect?
Yeah, it's a Libyan concept.
Yeah. It basically says, like, yeah, if you go to your city and you look around all the buildings and you want to predict, okay, which building is going to be here in 500 years? You might initially think, okay, this new skyscraper that's just launched up, this is going to be here in 500 years because it's newer. But actually, it's probably more likely to be like the old cathedral or the old library, essentially saying that stuff that's been here for a long time is more likely to be here in the future for a long time as well. And basically giving some virtue to the kind of original first principles or the original knowledge that's built up. So a Lindy person might say, you know, stop wasting your time on like Twitter and blog posts and new papers. Why don't you just go read Darwin, Origin of Species? Like, you'll learn way more from that. But so this paper is essentially saying that our focus on the older works and the foundational works is actually making it so that we're less disruptive in science. And they think the reason we're doing this is because it's too hard to keep up with the latest work. There's too much work being published. I think there's 1 million medical papers published a year, and they're super hard to read. So that was the reason they gave. So yeah, what? Any thoughts on those? Or
yeah, I mean, it's probably true, but there's also this whole thing of people don't do research because they're interested in research. They just want to up their citations, and it's just part of your career. I've had publications that I give like zero shits about, but I wanted my name on a paper because it would, you know, increase my odds of like landing a better job.
Yeah, I think in academia there's this like publish or perish model, and there's some kind of quantification and some yardsticks to hit right in terms of how much you publish. And not always the quality, obviously it is considered, but I think sometimes it's more about quantity. Interesting. So they suggested some solutions, and one of them was giving like early researchers just the opportunity to have a sabbatical where they just spend a year like reading, just learning and doing that instead of having this pressure to keep on publishing, which I think is a good idea.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic idea.
They also said funders should support more risky projects. So maybe the more kind of like venture capital approach rather than maybe a PE approach to research. And I think this, we don't have a lot of time, but there's the Vita DAO thing, which I think is quite interesting, where they're essentially, a DAO is essentially like a WhatsApp group with some money attached to it. And we're seeing that in, especially in the space of longevity, groups of people are getting together, putting some money together and funding really like loonshot mad ideas that wouldn't get support from traditional institutions.
Yeah, we need more of these like kind of Renaissance men who, you know, have their own like crazy lab and just do their own research or like fund some crazy idea. We do have some of those people, and I think it's becoming more fashionable. But yeah, the problem is a lot of this research is, the ROI on this research isn't clear. So that's where it comes down to either philanthropy or government support. Government support, unfortunately, it has the same problem as peer review. It's like you need to convince boards of people who are very set in their ways that this research is useful. So it comes down to philanthropy when it comes to these like weird moonshot ideas.
Last point. Have you heard of this iron law of institutions?
No.
So this is I believe it's a Soviet concept, but basically it says that any institution eventually just exists to exist. So that's a bit confusing. But basically it's like, you're like a fire department. Like they obviously they want to stop fires and their whole job is to fight fires. But if overnight I came up with an invention that made it so that all fires didn't exist, well, the fire department, they would all lose their jobs. So they want to stop fires, but they don't want all fires to stop either. So there is something about preserving your own existence. And I think academia has this kind of iron law of institution as well, where like it kind of becomes this game where the whole thing is just to publish or perish. And it's like this game where you're just publishing, but you might not necessarily be having like actual impact. Whereas these kind of Renaissance men or women who were doing this back in the day, they probably didn't give a shit. Like, you know, someone's giving them like 50K a year and they're just sat there just thinking of mad ideas. So, yeah, I think this applies.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds like a Telebian concept as well.
Yeah, I think I stole that from him. I think we're out of time. This was fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we got better towards the end, so we'll probably start like, I think with time we'll get better.
Yeah, I think so. And we've got like a lot of things to discuss. So, yeah, look forward to it. Okay, I'll stop recording. Awesome.